Our second case this morning is United States against Loughlin. Counsel for appellant, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, I am Captain Nicholas McHugh, and I represent the appellant, Colonel Loughlin. Your Honor, if it please the court, I would request 3 minutes rebuttal time.
Granted.
During appellant's court-martial, people inside the courtroom used cell phones to text testified information to victim witnesses who were outside of the courtroom. Appellant asks this court to remand for an Article 39A hearing to determine what testified information was relayed to those victim witnesses who were testifying against the appellant. The appellant's convictions for indecent assault rested entirely on the credibility of Ms. DLM, who was testifying against him. There were no eyewitnesses to the indecent assaults, and there were no admissions of guilt from the appellant in this case.
If you had a post-trial 39A, what's the judge supposed to do? Can he even bring these folks in? These people are by definition civilians, are they not? Can he subpoena these people?
Yes, Your Honor. It's correct that they were civilians.
Right.
At the time of trial, they were civilian employees, DOD employees.
Well, there was a message from a civilian DOD employee, but I think what she was saying was that others related to certain witnesses were sending the messages, and were those people civilian employees, or is there anything on the record to indicate what they were?
No, sir. There's nothing on the record to indicate what the people
were. Well, you know, assuming, arguendo, you could bring in the civilian employee who wrote the message.
Yes, Your Honor?
Can you bring in the people who actually sent the text messages? I mean, in a hypothetical 39A, can the military judge or whoever's running this 39A, can he bring in these people?
Yes, Your Honor. I think...
Can he compel them to come in?
I'm not sure about the question of can he compel them to come in.
Okay.
Whether or not the judge will subpoena.
Why aren't you sure? Why would he be lacking any authority to order a person who would have information relevant to a court-martial proceeding to appear and testify?
Your Honor, I don't see any reason why he would lack the authority to issue a subpoena or to order people who are under military control to actually testify.
And aside from that, for purposes of our proceeding today, do we operate on a presumption that a person who receives such a subpoena would contest it?
Your Honor, I don't believe that this court should operate under the assumption that that anyone will ignore or disobey a request or an order from a military judge, if I understand the question correctly.
So we're not presented with a situation where people were subpoenaed or were requested to come and decided not to come. That's not the situation we have. Nothing happened.
Correct, Your Honor. That is not the situation at the moment.
Under what restrictions were people operating at the time? Were they sequestered witnesses?
Your Honor, they were not officially sequestered by motion of the defense counsel. They had been instructed by the military judge at the conclusion of their testimony that they were subject to recall and that they were refrain from discussing the case with anybody else other than the attorneys.
But these are people who had not testified yet, right? The people receiving the email messages were not, had not testified yet.
That's an excellent question, Your Honor, and it's unclear. The order of testimony for the victim witnesses, Ms. DLM testified at the beginning of the government's case, and then Ms. P. testified later, and then the defense called back Ms. DLM to testify again. So at least Ms. DLM testified twice. So any messages that would have been relayed to her would have been relayed before her second testimony.
But, counsel, If there, and the record just seems completely blank on this, but it appears, and you just stated, that there was no motion from the defense to sequester the witnesses. So conceivably, those witnesses could have been in the courtroom. So where is the prejudice? If they didn't want him there, they would have made that motion, I would suspect.
Your Honor, that's a great question as far as the prejudice goes. But to address first the fact that the witnesses were not in the courtroom, there was no need for the defense to ask for them to be sequestered because they were not in the courtroom. I imagine if they had been in the courtroom, then perhaps the motion by the defense would have been ripe at that point to address the issue.
So the defense is supposed to keep on looking over their shoulder to see who's coming in or out and so on, and then quickly run in with a motion to sequester? That's the way it's done?
Yes, Your Honor. The defense has to keep an eye on any objection or any motion that they might want to raise.
And not just to take care of it at the outset.
Perhaps it would be a better practice if defense counsel would make it a practice of asking for sequestration at the beginning of each court martial that they attend. But at least in my experience, that's not what happens. That's not a matter in the record of trial.
Is there a difference between being sequestered and just being not permitted to remain in the courtroom while other people are testifying? Aren't those two different things?
Yes, Your Honor.
And do you know, or does the record reflect, or is there a rule that tells us what the ordinary practice is if a military judge sees a witness other than an expert witness who's returned to the court, who stays in, or tries to stay in the courtroom or returns to the courtroom after they've testified?
Your Honor, if there is a rule in regards to that specific scenario, I am not aware of it.
So does that mean what principle of law or rule is violated in the context of this case where there is no sequestration order with respect to texting to people outside?
Your Honor, I imagine that would depend on exactly what was said in those texts and whether the text messages were...
No, at the stage we're on, in or whatever, if the facts are it's solely contained within the King email...
Yes, Your Honor.
Is there a rule of law, principle of law, a rule of court-martial that on its face has been violated? Which is distinct from saying, if they had emailed out, go do this or go do that, it would have violated some principle of law. But is the mere act of the texting as stated in the email?
Your Honor, the mere act of texting a message to somebody outside of the courtroom, there is no rule of law against that. If there is one, I'm not aware of it.
But if there was a sequestration order, there certainly would be a problem.
Yes, Your Honor. That's
but you didn't, I took away that. I didn't give you a sequestration order. So.
Yes, Your Honor. I understand. Thank you, Your Honor.
Counsel, okay. does the record in this case establish whether the practice in this court-martial was for witnesses to be outside the courtroom before they were called to testify? Can we discern one way or another? I'm not talking about a rule or an order, just the practice and expectations of the parties. Is there anything we can tell from this record as to what their expectations would have been?
Your Honor, we can discern a lot simply from the email that was sent by the SARC's office. Just from that one email, we can discern not only that the victim witnesses were kept outside of the courtroom as a practice of that trial, but we can also discern that the communications occurred more than once. In her words, they occurred often. We can also discern that the information that was being relayed to them is being relayed to them throughout the, quote, whole trial. We can also discern that the text messages involved multiple parties, and we can discern that we have the family members of victim A sending text messages to both victims. That includes the victim A and victim B.
So in that context, is it the defense argument that if the defense had known of the text messaging, then the defense would have been able to cross-examine the witnesses as to whether their testimony had been coached? But without knowing about the text and messaging, they would have operated under the presumption that the witnesses were outside the courtroom and therefore had no knowledge of what went on inside.
Yes, Your Honor. And in fact, the defense counsel asked the witnesses about their contacts with each other, if they had contacted each other regularly, if they had contacted each other about this case specifically. And the witnesses were evasive during cross-examination. They would answer the question such as, we talk regularly, we don't talk about this case, and then they would have to be cross-examined on what you've said that you've talked to each other about this case. And it perhaps would have been very helpful to the defense if they had been able to ask follow-up questions of, in fact, isn't it true that the other victim witness's family members have been sending you text messages about what's been happening in this trial?
One of your theories is collusion between PP and DLF, correct?
Yes, Your Honor. The defense's theory was that these witnesses were working together to fabricate these allegations in order to support an EEO complaint against the Air Force.
Is there anything that would have prohibited the defense, when they became aware of the King email, from contacting these family members or witnesses and asking them what was communicated?
That's a great question, Your Honor. In the defense's clemency submission, I believe it's the clemency submission. It could be the post-trial 39A request. But they referenced the fact that they attempted to speak with the SARC about who exactly was involved in this. And they state that the SARC's responses were non-responsive, which is why they asked for the government's help in interviewing witnesses.
And did the defense seek to interview DLM and PP, who were government employees?
Not that I'm aware of, Your Honor.
You have DLM, you have P, and you have DLM again.
I believe that's correct, Your Honor.
Okay. By definition, DLM's up first, so there's no taint there, because nothing's happened yet.
Correct, Your Honor.
Wasn't he acquitted of anything involving P?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. So the only thing that's really an issue is DLM number two.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
That's fair to say.
Okay. I'm trying to narrow it down. Right. Okay.
With the defense's theory, what they argued in closing was that these two witnesses were connected, that they were combined, that they were the same person. It's interesting that given the defense's argument and the government's attack to the defense's argument, that the jury came back with split findings in this case. If you read the argument of counsel, you'd be surprised to find out later on that the jury did not believe, that the jury acquitted with respect to Ms. P, and yet they didn't buy in, at least not hook, line, and sinker, they didn't buy in to the defense's argument that these witnesses were working together to fabricate a story. If they had believed that argument, then they would have acquitted as to all the indecent assault specifications. However, what's clear in this case is that the jury did not buy into that argument, at least not totally. And that's where the appellant believes there could be prejudice in this case. Now, with regards to where this case is at right now, the denial of the post-trial 39A hearing, we are requesting that this court remand so that we can have that post-trial 39A session. We're not asking for a dismissal of the charges or a new trial at this point yet, but we would like to have the post-trial 39A session to determine if that's necessary. And in reviewing the convening authority's decision as to whether or not to grant a post-trial 39A session, the appellant points out that that decision is normally reviewed for an abuse of discretion standard. However, we would ask that that decision not be reviewed for abuse of discretion standard in this case, simply because there's no evidence that the convening authority ever even received the request. There's no evidence that the convening authority ever even knew that the appellant was requesting a post-trial 39A session.
Let's assume we operate on a presumption of regularity, or otherwise assume that the request was received. Excuse me. What is your position as to whether there was or was not an abuse of discretion here by the convening authority?
Your Honor, if I may, I'll break my answer up into two parts to address Your Honor's question. First, with regards to the presumption of regularity.
I'm not asking about the presumption of regularity. Let's assume that that the information was received and that the convening authority acted on it. What's your position as to whether there was or was not an abuse of discretion and why?
Your Honor, we don't know. We don't know what facts the convening authority looked at. We don't know what standard the convening authority used. We don't know if he had the, we don't know what the convening authority actually used to make his decision.
Let's assume that the convening authority received the information that was presented. Did the convening authority abuse discretion or not as to granting the Article 39A session?
Your Honor, we still don't know without having some kind of inkling about what process he used.
No, just based on the facts that we do have.
The facts
question
that we,
is not, I understand you'd like to know what else happened or what did the CA consider, et cetera. But imagine that the only thing he had to consider was whatever you submitted and whatever the record reflects the SJA submitted. Full stop.
Yes, Your Honor.
On that record, why did he abuse his discretion?
Your Honor, maybe I don't understand the question, but my answer still doesn't change, because even if the convening authority had all the facts, even the facts that we don't know, if he had all the facts in front of him, we don't know whether he abused his discretion, because we don't know what standard he applied or what law he applied or how he made his decision.
Counsel, we have a record before us, and we have to decide whether or not the convening authority abused his discretion. You want us to decide on some other basis. Maybe we will. But if we get to the point of deciding on abuse of discretion, what is the position of the defense with respect to the record that's before us?
I understand now, Your Honor. Thank you. Your Honor, in this case, I believe it's in the gray area of discretion. The appellant's position is that he could have gone either way.
Well, then why is it an abuse of discretion? You are to be commended for your honesty and for arguing all the facts of the case, but why does a gray area equal abuse of discretion?
Your Honor, a gray area typically does not equal abuse of discretion, but it does in this case, where there's no evidence that it was ever, the 39A post-trial request was ever even forwarded.
That's not the question.
I understand the answer. Yeah.
Fair enough. What you're really saying is this case is predicated, from your standpoint, on a lack of indicia in the record that the CA ever did consider what you've put before the court.
Yes, Your Honor, and I see my time has expired.
Counsel, can I ask a question for you to address on rebuttal, please, which is whether the record reflects or whether you otherwise can point us to a regulation or law that dictates the circumstances under which defense counsel may contact alleged putative victims directly when there is a SARC.
Thank you, Your Honor. Are there any further questions?
Thank you, Counsel. You have an opportunity on rebuttal. Counsel for the government.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. I'm Major Charles Warren, and along with Mr. Roger Bruce, I represent the United States government in this case. Your Honors, the military judge did not abuse his discretion. The convening authority did not abuse his discretion in declining to grant an Article 39A in this case, where the record before him was speculative and bereft of any factual detail indicating any possibility of factual prejudice occurring as a result of these alleged text messages. Moving to issue one, which was not addressed by
you, say there are alleged text messages. So you think the email, the King email, you're adopting the CCA's view that because this email is not under oath, we should just disregard it? This is a government employee reporting to government people about what occurred, and you say, don't trust it.
No, Your Honor, we're not saying that you have to disregard the email from Ms. King. Obviously, that's part of the record. The text messages are any indication about substantively what was in them is not part of the record, and presumption.
So the alleged part is that the text messages, as to what they said, not that they occurred.
Yes, Your Honor. As to the content of those text messages and whether they had any possible capacity to actually alter witness testimony, which would be the only way the prejudice would arise.
How could the convening authority make a decision about whether there should be an Article 39A session when he has no idea what's in the text messages.
Well, Your Honor, we believe that this is a...
But, I mean, isn't it rather circular? You know, they failed to show that they're relevant because they haven't shown what's in them, but he can decide whether or not there should be a 39A session even though he doesn't know what's in them?
Yes, Your Honor. The government, as a matter of to respond to your question, in the first instance, believes that the convening authority's exercise of discretion should be evaluated based upon the record that was placed before him. The issue then turns to whose responsibility is it to give the convening authority a sufficient basis in order to place his decision on whether to grant an Article 39A session. Here the record indicates that after defense counsel received this general notification that there may have been text messages communicated to the witnesses during the course of trial, defense counsel made a blanket request.
No. You just said you turned it into an alleged again. There were text messages, right? It's the what was said that's the issue.
Yes, Your Honor. Okay. Yes, Your Honor. Rather than seeking out any further investigation as to the source of that email or to the witnesses concerned, the defense presented no additional factual matters to the convening authority, leaving the convening authority solely with this email without any indication how any of these...
What is your response to the question that I asked and Judge Ryan asked as to whether there was a principle of law that would preclude the defense counsel from contacting DLM or PP, government employees, and asking them the question?
No, Your Honor. The government does not believe there's any principle of law that would prevent defense counsel from... engaging
it's appropriate in a, to directly contact victims.
What about the Victim Witness Assistance Act, or VWAP?
Yes, Your Honor. The VWAP program permits for victim liaisons to be present during a witness questioning, but does not forbid the questioning of these witnesses. There's that they are not criminal defendants in any sense of the word. The contacting of the witnesses by the defense counsel would not be a violation of their ethical rules unless they were represented by counsel, which was itself an issue in the trial, so that there would be no
explicit... So the defense counsel can contact a rape victim and hope that the victim knows to contact the victim witness assistance person to be present when they talk?
Well, Your Honor,
is that the way it actually works?
Well, Your Honor, certainly the preferred practice would be for defense counsel to notify the government.
I'm not asking about preferred practice. I'm asking what the rules actually require.
Yes, ma'am. Under AFI 51201, which is our Administration of Military Justice, the Victim Witness Assistance Program entitles victims to have the assistance of victim support liaisons present at the questioning by counsel in relationship to the case that they're testifying in. In this case, the government's position would be that the defense would have every right to contact the government, notify them that they intend on questioning these witnesses, and for the witnesses in turn to have the VSLs, victim support liaisons, present if that was their preference. There's simply no prohibition against them engaging in this sort of post-trial investigation that would inform their request for 39A of the convening.
Well, counsel, we actually have two things that we're looking at here. We have the text messages that were sent, but then we also have the VSL's email in which he specifically said, we rotated victim advocates being with him and sitting in the courtroom to give them accurate feedback. And when she's talking about them, she's talking about the witnesses who are not in the courtroom. So here we have an allegation, or here we have a statement by the VSL that she and her people are telling witnesses what's going on in the courtroom. The defense approached her, and she was not forthcoming. So at that point, how are they supposed to know what's going on?
And, Your Honor, with respect to the issue that defense approached her, the government would note that that is a one-line notation on page 325 of the Joint Appendix. Because Ms. King has chosen to be evasive, we must avail ourselves to the court again.
Does it matter whether it's two paragraphs or one line?
Well, Your Honor, we think that it matters from the extent of showing what reasonable efforts were undertaken by the defense to create a record upon which the convening authority can make an informed decision about whether to grant a post-trial 39A.
And in looking at whether or not the convening authority can make an informed decision, what is there in the record that shows that he was even aware of this request?
Well, Your Honor, we have the, admittedly in the record there is no explicit notation that the convening authority received the request, but we do have the notation, we have the notation of the request for the post-trial 39A and the SDR addendum that was related to the convening authority.
And for what reason? What was the reason for the 39A in that addendum?
The SDR addendum recited that the defense, and pardon Your Honor, I can flip right to the page. The defense also states that they requested evidence after the trial and that the request was denied by the government. And so it was a summary recital of
the action that was presented. So that didn't tell the convening authority of any of the specifics of this situation?
Well, Your Honor, and again, the government would rely upon a presumption of regularity in the delivery of this request. And the defense counsel also noted in their clemency request itself to the convening authority, although not the explicit request for 39A, but noted it therein.
What about the joint appendix, I guess, page 323, where there's an email, I think, from Captain Landry to Captain Poulin that basically says that the substance of it is that he's talked to Colonel Rome regarding requests for the official position on the text messages sent by friends, family during court-martial. We feel that the government's not under any obligation to produce the text of those messages. What does that have to do with defense efforts or the government's refusal to assist them in perhaps getting the information needed for the post-trial 39A session?
Yes, Your Honor. As an initial matter, we would note that the defense never moved the military judge for any sort of motion to compel post-trial discovery when they had the opportunity to do so, having not received apparently what they deemed to be an adequate response during the course of this post-trial process. And we believe that that sort of waiver by the defense should weigh against them in their efforts in being
I understand that, but I mean, it seems to me that you're saying that, you know, that it's the defense's own gosh-darn fault, you know, because they didn't provide any information to the convening authority, and that it's okay that the convening authority made a decision even though he actually didn't have any information. And you're saying the defense didn't do anything. And on the one hand, they contacted the SARC, and on the other hand, they appeared to have asked the government and got nowhere. And so, I mean, I suppose you could make the argument that they were completely ineffective, which would be one way to proceed, or you could ask why the government and the SARC, which is also part of the government, wouldn't want this information to be relayed to the defense so that the convening authority would have everything in front of him to make a proper decision. I'm not saying that he abuses discretion. I don't know. That's a question that we're here to decide. But I'm asking a different question, which is, you know, whose responsibility is it for the convening authority to have the information in front of him in order to make an adequately informed decision?
Your Honor, as the moving party for the RCM, under RCM 1102, the government would respectfully submit that it's the defense's responsibility to create a factual record upon which the convening authority can make an informed decision. In this case, setting aside whether it was proper or improper for the government not to conduct an investigation post-trial in response to the defense's request, the government would respectfully submit that there was no prejudice in this case from the failure to hold an Article 39A session when the record makes it manifest that there was essentially a factual impossibility that there was any actual altering of testimony for the one pertinent witness around whom this would possibly have an impact, that being DLM. The reason there being the sequence of the calling of the witnesses, as we've already identified today at oral argument, DLM was called first, therefore there could be no collusional impact on the initial part of her testimony from text messages. When she was then, PP was all of the charges upon which she testified were acquitted, so no prejudice could attach there. When DLM was recalled, she was recalled for one specific purpose about her attorney-client representation, and she stayed the exact same course as her initial testimony. Therefore, if the text messages could have had no impact on her initial testimony on that point, the text messages, whatever their information was, had no impact on the sole issue for which she was recalled. In the absence of any altering that witness testimony, the government respectfully submits where no prejudice lies, that the court can resolve the case on that basis alone.
So it's the government's view that if the text messages were to say, in effect, here's what's being testified here, and here's how you can alter your testimony to take advantage of it, that wouldn't have had any impact on the members.
Well, Your Honor, if we had any of that evidence before us, potentially, that sort of evidence could have the tendency to diminish the credibility.
Right, but we don't know, because when the defense brought this matter to the attention of the convening authority decided there was nothing worth following up on.
Based upon the bare record that was placed before him.
Right. And why is it the burden on the defense to do anything more when you're in the midst of a trial and post-trial proceedings to bring information like this to the attention of the decision maker so the decision maker can decide whether or not further information is required? That is, does the government really want a situation where instead of notifying either the military judge when the 39A is under the province of the military judge, or the convening authority when it's under the province of the convening authority, instead of notifying them, the defense goes out and starts interviewing witnesses and conducting its own investigation? Is that a better position for the military justice system to be in?
Well, Your Honor, the government would respectfully submit that placing some evidentiary burden on the defense as a matter of first instance is not unprecedented in military law.
Well, if they have an initial burden and they produce an email that shows that there is text messages from the SARP, right? I mean, so it's not like it's, you know, from the appellant's, you know, wife or friend or sister that says, oh, I saw them text messaging. It's from the SARP that says that it's happened. Okay. Let me finish, counsel.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
You know, and it seems to me that your position is that, you know, it's the defense's fault, even though both the witnesses and the ability to get the information is within the hands of the government. You said, well, it's the defense's problem. Whose convening authority is it? I mean, which one of the counsel, the defense counsel or the trial counsel, has a relationship with the convening authority? Because my recollection is it's not the defense counsel.
Yes, Your Honor. Under military law, obviously, both counsel have access to the convening authority. Any attempts to limit access would be unlawful.
And which one, of course, but which one would the convening authority call to get advice on this question? The staff judge or the trial counsel? You're not suggesting that convening authorities don't communicate with their trial counsel, do you?
No, Your Honor.
What did the defense counsel fail to do that they should have done, that which, in your view, puts the onus on them and the failure on them in this case?
Your Honor, in this case, having received what was, relatively speaking, vague information relating to text messages relating to witnesses without any other information, a prudent move to determine whether there was actually relevant and necessary information that had a potential impact on the legality of the proceedings would be to follow up with the witnesses concerned and ascertain what, if any, information they actually received from these text messages, and that there was no prohibition under AFI 51201 or any other provision of military law that would keep them from having a post-trial interview with the witnesses under these circumstances.
So contacting the government to do that was not adequate in your view?
Well, Your Honor, the issue would be, does the government have an obligation to initiate a post-trial investigation when it is the defense's request? Apparently, that's what the defense would have us do. The defense is overt.
Well, but the defense produced this email. So how is the government initiating an anything? The defense is initiating it. You got this email, which is rather problematical, and the government's just saying, well, we don't have to do anything.
Well, Your Honor, the government did not attempt to obscure this email or...
I'm not accusing the government of bad faith. I'm saying how much defense has to do.
Well, Your Honor, the government would analogize this to a situation, for example, a request for an expert witness in a case. The defense has a situation where they think an expert may be applicable for whatever reason. They must do more than come forward and simply say, well, this is a... rape case, so I want a forensic psychologist to evaluate the victim.
They have an email from the SARC. It's not analogous at all. There's an email from the SARC saying that this was happening. The defense counsel asked for the government's assistance in looking at the text of what the messages were. If the government had done that and there was nothing in the messages, it would have been a moot point. But instead, the government said, it's our position that you know, we don't have to do that, and we're not going to. And I guess why would that be the government's position? Why wouldn't the government want to know what those text messages were? Because maybe they were completely innocuous and maybe they weren't. But wouldn't it have been better for you to be able to tell the convening authority?
Yes, Your Honor, the government would agree that in a perfect world that those text messages would have been disclosed and known to all parties. The government's position here on appeal is that there was no prejudice from the failure to grant a 39A to looking into those text messages when there was no possibility that the content of them, whatever they may be, altered DLM's testimony. And in the absence of actual altering of testimony, any error in refusing to grant the 39A is mooted.
Counsel, can I turn to issue one for a moment before you run out of time?
Yes, Your Honor.
The accused here was charged under Article 133.
Yes, Your Honor.
And he was charged with making unsolicited comments of a sexual nature to Chief Master Sergeant R.M. Where in the record did the government establish that the accused had notice that that was a criminal offense? Because obviously under 133 is the way that's charged and, you know, the custom of the service and other things that define what that notice is.
Yes, Your Honor. The government's position is that in keeping with the precedent of the Supreme Court dating back from Parker versus Levy and is also recognized by this court in United States versus Rogers, that fair notice can be created by constructive notice. And that constructive notice, in turn, drawing from the concurrence in Rogers, could stem from court decisions from this court, MCM examples of conduct unbecoming, various customs of the service, and which themselves could be represented through service regulations and the like, and also miscellaneous factors dealing with the accused himself, or in particular command experience and age and rank of the accused.
Okay, well, here we have a colonel who admits that these were inappropriate comments. And the question before us is whether or not he had noticed that those comments were of a criminal nature. And as we look back in the Air Force, back in 2005, we had a major general who was accused of 13 specific instances of inappropriate conduct. And of those, they involved unwelcome sexual advances with subordinate officers, with enlisted people, and with civilian employees. There was no criminal charges ever brought against him. He wasn't charged under the Uniform Code of Military Justice. This is a case that received a great deal of attention. And what would that tell an individual in this situation as to what is criminal and what is not in this admittedly somewhat nebulous area of sexual comments and sexual harassment, what have you?
Yes, Your Honor. To be fair, the incident that Your Honor refers to involving the former Air Force TJAG did result in nonjudicial punishment. While that is not a criminal case, under nonjudicial punishment, charges must still be a violation of the UCMJ.
But it wasn't a criminal charge, and this was a criminal charge.
Yes, Your Honor, but the discretion of a convening authority in selecting forum discretion.
Well, I agree with that. I'm just talking here about notice. I mean, there may be all kinds of reasons why they did that. But what we're left with here is the impression that it would give a non-legal individual in the Air Force as to where that line is drawn.
Yes, Your Honor, and I see my time will likely expire during my response.
You can take the time you need to answer that question.
Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honor, the government's position is that one instance of the Air Force making a form decision for a particular officer does not negate the pre-existing customs of the service as evidenced by Air Force Instruction 362909, which was recognized in this court in United States versus Rogers as providing evidence of the custom. It does not negate the codal provisions coming into play here with bearing on the interests of fraternization and maltreatment themselves, demonstrating a custom of the service against sexually explicit offensive comments directed from a superior mission support group commander to an enlisted person, and that under those circumstances, two wrongs don't make a right, essentially, Your Honor, that the Air Force's decision on how to deal with the misconduct of the Major General
you have to admit that a case with that much visibility sends a message to other people in the Air Force, does it not?
Yes, Your Honor. It potentially could send a message that members of the Air Force could disagree with how that Major General was dealt with in that particular circumstance. But the fact that the Major General was disciplined, albeit not in a court-martial sentence, would not send the message.
This guy's not arguing that this was inappropriate. You know, and I mean, in a normal case, this would have been handled through sexual harassment channels, would it not? As it was with the general.
Counsel, could he have been charged with an orders violation for sexual harassment, or did she need to be offended?
Under sexual harassment, arguably, Your Honor, this may not have risen all the way to that level, but the government would respectfully distinguish this case from United States versus Brown, where the court held that the failure of the government to meet the level of sexual harassment under the Air Force pamphlet negated a conduct unbecoming spec, where in that case, the government overtly adopted that as their standum of custom of the service, whereas this court has consistently ruled in concert with the Supreme Court that is not a direct obligation on the government, that the government need not provide explicit proof of the customs of the service, but can rely upon what the court in Parker called further content need to be supplied by less formalized custom.
Is there any question, and I'm going with custom of the service, I'm assuming that in the Air Force, if his offers had been received and the acts that he contemplated had been consummated, would that have violated the custom of the service of the Air Force? In other words, if he had sexual relations with this woman, would that have violated the customs of the service in the Air Force?
Yes, Your Honor, the government would respond that would constitute fraternization.
Under the circumstances of Spec 2, do you look at the circumstances of Spec 1?
Yes, Your Honor, we believe that you do to provide the full context of the communications involved here. And this has been a course of conduct that the court has undertaken to determine the indecency and decorum of this particular language involved, to give it life, as it were, so that one can understand how this specifically tended to disgrace the officer personally and bring dishonor upon the military profession.
What distinguishes Specification 1 from Specification 2?
Yes, Your Honor. Specification 1 is essentially the ends. Specification 2 is a means by which the accused sought to obtain that ends. And in a circumstance like this, both are criminal. It's similar to a circumstance where an accused set out to go rob a bank and on his way robbed a gun store and grabbed the gun and brought in there and used the gun to commit the burglary. The fact that the means and the ends both involve criminal conduct, it doesn't mean that we can only criminalize one or the other. In this circumstance, the relationship was the ends, and the communication were the means by which you sought to attain that ends, and were themselves separately punishable.
So what if he just pulled her, what if he just pulled her on her home phone just to chat? Would that constitute conduct unbecoming an officer and a gentleman?
Well, Your Honor, potentially not, depending upon the context of that conversation. Unfortunately, in this case, that is not what we have here. We have a circumstance where a senior officer sought to follow up in private, outside of prying eyes, with a sexually explicit line of dialogue that was continued despite the Chief Master Sergeant attempting to rebuff those advances, and which did not abate until other circumstances conspired to actually remove the chief from the colonel's everyday presence. And, Your Honor, I know I've gone far.
That's fine. Why doesn't that bleed over into relate the two specifications together as opposed to making them separate?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
I don't understand why that makes it a separate offense. That is, haven't you just tied the two specifications together to make one offense?
Well, Your Honor, that could have been accomplished here. I mean, certainly the first specification could have said that he sought the unprofessional relationship by means of and then reciting the particular communications. That would have been a permissible way to charge it, and perhaps the preferable way to charge it.
So I think some of what the questions are going to, why, absent blending the two together, does the one become an offense by itself?
Yes, Your Honor. The government respectfully submits that this court is permitted to look at the context in determining whether these communications will rise to the level of being conduct unbecoming. And for that purpose, although there is some mutual evidence upon which both specifications can be considered, it does not preclude criminality of the second.
If there are any further questions, you'll have the opportunity now to briefly conclude.
Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honor, a senior Air Force officer was on fair notice that sexually explicit comments to a subordinate non-commissioned officer against her will were conduct unbecoming an officer and a gentleman, and where the convening authority declined to grant an Article 39A in the absence of specific factual allegations that could amount to any prejudice on the testimony of the witnesses concerned, there was no abuse of discretion.
Was she a subordinate, or was she junior in grade? Was she the wing chief, command chief?
Yes, Your Honor, she was a command chief, so commander. I apologize for the inarticulate use of subordinate.
She was junior in grade, for sure.
Yes, Your Honor.
But she was not technically a subordinate, was she?
No, Your Honor, not beneath his command. Okay. Yes, Your Honor, not beneath his direct chain of command. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. Does the defense have rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor.
Your Honor, in response to the question about VWAP and what right the defense counsel has to interview a witness post-trial without going through the victim advocacy office, I admit that I'm not as well read on those regulations as maybe I should be. My understanding.
Rather than give us your understanding, if you want to submit the information after this, that would be fine. I prefer that you not go on something other than what's actually the fact.
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you.
That's okay. Is that okay?
All right, my understanding that'll be an opportunity for the defense, not a formal request from the court.
It's an opportunity. You don't have to.
Well, how do we know if the defense is availing themselves of this opportunity? And what is the government's opportunity to respond to the opportunity?
As always, the parties have the opportunity to submit matters post-trial. Whether the court will accept them, of course, is another matter. There's no window here unless there's a formal request from the court, and I am not perceiving that there's a formal request from the court this time.
Do you intend to submit something at this time, to your knowledge?
Your Honor, respectfully, I'll wait till Your Honors finish discussing whether or not I should.
We're not having, unless the court issues an order, we will be in the same position we are in any case, and that is the court will proceed to decide the case. If the parties submit something, the court will receive that in due course.
Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honor, do you want an answer right now?
I don't, but I'm just trying to caution that obviously the theory is that you submit something before the case is decided, and if there's no deadline,
no,
you're welcome to submit something 3 years from now. But
our conference is on Thursday.
if the appellant avails itself of the opportunity, I will submit something no later than close of business tomorrow, and that way the government will at least have 24 hours.
And you can always submit. I mean, I don't know, but you can always submit something saying you're going to submit something.
Right.
Right.
That's true.
Do a bonfire signal of some sort.
Yes, Your Honor.
Kind of yucky weather now, but you could do something to signal.
Wigwags.
So to summarize where we are in this, the court has not made a request. Counsel has indicated that if a matter will be submitted by close of business on Wednesday.
Or if you'd like, you can go back
on
and
Tuesday.
Up your
close
best
of business on Tuesday.
Yes, Your Honor, tomorrow.
Okay, thank you.
I see my time is about
to.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
On issue one, are you arguing holistically, or are you arguing one spec and then the other spec?
Your Honor, I think perhaps the issue was stated most succinctly in a question asked by Judge Efron of the government, which is that it seems that this charge was really one specification.
So then why didn't the defense file something at the trial saying multiplication of charges or whatever it's supposed to do? If that was an issue, they proceeded with the two specs.
That's correct, Your Honor. I think maybe perhaps the defense wanted to fight the second specification because of how it was worded. Specifically, it's worded that the appellant used unsolicited sexual comments.
So is it your view that the second specification under the circumstances does not include the circumstances of the first specification?
It's solely because of how it's drafted, yes, Your Honor.
So, in your view, under the circumstances means as if you were in a sealed tube, and the only facts, the pure facts, the only facts to be considered for legal sufficiency are the communications.
No, Your Honor.
So under the circumstances would also include all the other stuff?
Your Honor, I believe it would. For the specification to still be legally sufficient, the government would have had to have shown that at a minimum, the abuser had made unsolicited sexual comments. And I don't believe the government showed that in light of the witness's testimony that...
Oh, so this is, you're arguing a sort of a pure legal sufficiency case, which is the facts just aren't there.
Yes, Your Honor.
You're not arguing that a colonel in the Air Force who is a group commander would not have fair notice that you can't try to have sex with a person junior in grade by calling them at home and doing all this stuff. Your point is the facts don't show that, not that that's not a crime.
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you.
I see my time has expired.
You'll take the time you need. If you had a quick point you wanted to make in rebuttal, and then you'll have an opportunity to make a closing statement.
Thank you, Your Honor. I have only one point I wanted to make in rebuttal, and I appreciate being allowed to get to it. In the government's argument, they argued in part that that there's no possibility that the testimony was altered. So I'd like to first say that the defense's position is that this is relevant whether the testimony was altered or not because of the cross-examination material it would have provided. It's just the fact that the witnesses were working together with their families to get their testimony straight in and of itself shows prejudice. But secondly, that we do have evidence that they altered at least one part of their testimony, and that's with regard to a particular question that was asked of both witnesses, and they both answered it the same way. The question that was asked to the witnesses was, first it was asked to Ms. P. on page 188 of the joint appendix. She was asked, "You filed workman's comp complaints?" And her answer was, "Nothing has left this base." It's a yes or no question, and if her answer is that she filed something and it's not a formal filing yet, but it might be later on after the trial, then perhaps you would expect that she would have answered it that way. But instead she said, "Nothing has left this base." And then later, page 216, a member asks Ms. DLM the same question. "So you're saying a complaint was not filed with EEO? Is that what I'm hearing?" And the answer is, "There is no complaint at this point in time that has left this base." So respectfully, we have evidence that the witnesses at least are giving the same evasive answer to the same direct question. I know it's not direct evidence that the two were colluding and planning out what they were going to testify to, but it is strange. And in light of the fact, in light of what the SARC's email gives us, it seems that we at least know that this might have been happening, that it might have affected their specific testimony. And with that, I will briefly conclude unless there are further questions. Your Honor, the appellant in this case, Colonel Lofton, asks only that this court order that his case be remanded for a post-trial Article 39A hearing to determine the exact contents of those emails and communications so that it can be determined whether or not a new trial is warranted under these circumstances. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Thank both counsel for your presentation today. The case is submitted, and the court will be in recess until 9:30 a.m. tomorrow morning.
Court stands in recess until 9:30 a.m. tomorrow.